proceed to the fourth case of the day, Manning versus Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Judge. May it please the court, if with the court's indulgence, I would try to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. The appeal in this case is from a civil suit that was brought against two FBI agents and others, the two agents being the only appellants here at this stage. The district court issued a ruling denying these agents absolute or qualified immunity, and it's those issues that we've brought here on appeal. Since the district court rendered its ruling, there's been a development in the case. At the time, early stage of the case, counsel for both sides were unaware, and therefore the court was not made aware, that in fact these two agents, who are the appellants here, did testify at the plaintiff's criminal murder trial. There was a motion to supplement the record. Since the appeal was filed in the district court, it was granted, and the transcript of that testimony is in the record now for the court's review. Manning himself called both agents as witnesses for the defense at the criminal trial. That being said, that simplifies the immunity issues here considerably because, first of all, it means that these defendants, as witnesses who testified at trial, are entitled to the absolute immunity accorded to witnesses who are alleged to have committed perjury under the Supreme Court's decision in Briscoe. It also brings this case on all fours with this court's decision in House versus Belford, which said that when you testify at trial, you're entitled to the absolute Briscoe immunity, but if the claim is repackaged as a claim that you conspired to perjure, to create perjured testimony at trial, that too is covered by the immunity, because otherwise it is simply too easy to make an end run and plead around the absolute immunity. So that's very significant here. And the issue at this point is whether there are any other ways of making an end run around the doctrines of absolute immunity. One is the plaintiff's argument that because these two agents and a third party, all of whom testified at trial and whose testimony covered all of the subjects alleged to have been part of the conspiracy to create perjury that's alleged in this complaint, because they all testified at trial and they all spoke together in preparing their testimony, that therefore, although I believe they recognize they can't sue these two agents for their testimony directly, and they can't sue them on a claim that they conspired to perjure themselves, they can instead sue them on a claim that they conspired to have Dye perjure himself, the third party, and they can sue the others for the other's testimony. But it's all the same testimony, it's covering the same subjects. That daisy chain of conspiracy cannot be used to create an end run about around the absolute immunity. Second, and the point that the district court focused on here, if you look at in the blue brief bound in at the back of the appendix there, page 29, which is part of the district court's opinion, the district court construed the claim raised in this case as a claim, this is at the top of page 29, that these two agents coached the third party to commit perjury, that they themselves committed perjury or lied, and that they withheld from the prosecutors what? That they were in fact lying. They withheld their knowledge that they were lying. That is what this court construes as a Brady claim. It's not a natural or traditional Brady claim. A traditional Brady claim, as the court well knows, is a claim that there's a lot of evidence available to the police and prosecutors, some of which is inculpatory, some of which is exculpatory, only the inculpatory evidence is turned over and all the contradictory exculpatory evidence is withheld. That's not what's at issue here. They're not claiming that they were withheld any specific evidence, any tapes, any transcripts, any reports. Instead, what they're saying was withheld, and what the district court understood the claim to be is, you gave us everything, but you didn't tell us that it was false. That's not the sort of Brady claim that is recognized by the courts, and in fact, in the Supreme Court's decision in Imbler versus Packman, the prosecutorial absolute immunity case, the Supreme Court directly confronted an argument that was made by the dissenting Justice White in that case, where the dissenting justice said, I understand that these prosecutors are alleged to have used perjured testimony. There's absolute immunity for that. But what we should see this claim instead of is a claim that they suppressed from the defense that they were using perjured testimony, a direct end run around the prosecutorial immunity, and claimed it portrayed it as a Brady claim. The court in Imbler directly addressed that claim and rejected it, said that that could not be allowed because it would eviscerate the absolute immunity by creating an end run around it. That's footnote 34 of the court's opinion in Imbler versus Packman. They said that it is not practical to separate out the use of the perjured testimony, which is immune, from the failure to tell them you were using it, which the dissent thought should not be immune, but the court said no, have to be drawn within the immunity. That's the same argument here.
Well, Ms. Corey, Manning doesn't merely allege the agent's coach died a lie. At least the allegation is that the agents created and submitted to the prosecution false written reports stating that Manning had confessed when he knew he had not?
We address this at page 5 of our reply brief where we address the scope of the testimony that was given by these two agents. And we address it again at page 12 of our reply. All of the allegations of a conspiracy that are contained in this complaint, which pertain to Manning's murder trial, there are allegations that go to the shaping, the coaching, the development of the testimony, the recording of it in a report, the taping of it on a tape, none of which is alleged to have been withheld from the defense.
Isn't there a charge that they possibly destroyed physical evidence?
No, I don't believe so.
That's not a charge that Manning makes?
I don't believe so. I believe what they suggest is that they may have altered the tape. But the tape is given to them, and in fact, what's at issue here is what was said, was it true or was it false? Dye testifies about all of those matters at trial, as do Agent Buchan and Agent Miller, and that's covered in the transcript of their testimony, now part of the record. This is all of what they testified about, and these are the allegations of conspiracy contained in the complaint. So I think that the absolute immunity is now clear, and it was not clear to the district court, in all candor, that transcript had not been made available. I don't fully understand why, but it was preliminary stage of the case. But we now are brought directly within Briscoe. We're brought within House. We're on all fours with those cases, and the issue that remains is what kind of end run can be made around that by pleading this artfully in the complaint. And again, the Supreme Court has said very clearly that if these immunities are to be upheld, you cannot allow a plaintiff to simply repackage their claim and allow that to move around the immunity and bring all of these lawsuits. If you allow a lawsuit for a Brady claim for failing to disclose that everything you gave them, which is everything you had, some of it was actually false, then in any case, the criminal trial will be replayed in a civil suit later where the allegation will be, well, we had everything. Sure, we're not alleging the normal Brady claim in that respect if something specific was withheld, as was the case, for example, in Newsom, where there are inconsistent fingerprint matches and there were inconsistent lineup identifications, or in Ianco, where there was an ICSC Leeds report that was withheld from the plaintiffs that contradicted the police account. Here, the allegation is, we gave you everything, but we didn't tell you that it was false. Well, in any case, then, after the fact, the criminal trial gets replayed in a civil suit where the allegation is, we want to put the officers on the stand, or the prosecutor, whoever it may be, and ask whether they knew, or what they knew, or what their state of mind was about what was being said at the trial. That is a way to put the perjured testimony, allegedly perjured testimony, directly on trial, and it's a way to plead around the absolute immunity and eviscerate it, which the Supreme Court said in Imbler could not be done.
Well, at the same time, though, it seems that
possible, but just by testifying, they insulate themselves for all the bad acts that occurred before the testimony. Where does the, for instance, in the manufacturing of the evidence, we'll call it, when does that come outside of the testimonial immunity?
When there is any sort of physical evidence that is not disclosed to the defense, particularly as in Newsom is a good example. There was contradictory evidence that the police had at their disposal. They had inconsistent fingerprint matches. They had lineup identifications that contradicted the lineup identification offered at trial. They didn't make those available to the defendant. That's a classic Brady violation, and it is appropriate grounds for constitutional violation. But where the allegation is, you gave them what you were supposed to give them, but you didn't tell them it was false.
That's the tape or something?
Yes. You didn't tell them that there was...
But you manufactured it. Or you?
Well, they didn't manufacture the tape.
Okay, what they... I don't want to say characterized it, doctored it, or set it up or something. But
yeah, I think I understand Your Honor's question. There could be an extreme version of the witness immunity that would say, if you talk about it at trial, no matter what you may have done elsewhere or out of court, or you planted a glove at the site or whatever it may be, that somehow that all becomes immune because you simply talked about it at trial.
Well, how do you address the Brady situation or the potential Brady situation of where you create, rather than withhold evidence, you have the same effect by creating false evidence? That's never going to be Brady.
It will never be Brady if the false evidence is testimony. If it's testimony.
Well, if it's a report, what if the charge is that it's a report? You just create a false report.
Okay.
And so you're not withholding the truth or impeaching evidence when you create a false report?
You have to turn that report over to the defense, and if later the allegation is it's manufactured, what the Supreme Court has said, and this, by the way, is comparable. It's virtually the same allegation that the Supreme Court faced in the Imbler case. There the allegation was the prosecutor used perjured testimony. He knew it was false. It's just as serious as the allegations here. In all of these cases, in Briscoe itself, the allegation was that the witness, the police officer, had presented perjured testimony on the stand. What the court has said in those instances, where it involves testimony, is that you'll have to rely on government remedies. You can prosecute the person criminally, you can terminate them and discipline them, but you cannot leave it to private litigants to do that, because if you do that, you open up this Pandora's box of every witness, every law enforcement officer, every investigator, every prosecutor can be roundabout backed into a civil trial, and it's just not tenable in our system because it will gum up the gears of the judicial system in a way that the Supreme Court has refused to countenance. If I may reserve the balance of my time.
Sure, Mr. Carter. Mr. Lowy.
My name is John Lovey. I represent the appellee, Steve Manning. And this case represents a very straightforward application of this court's precedent in Newsom, wherein this court held that if someone improperly induces a witness to falsely finger somebody for a crime and then withholds the details of that scheme from the prosecutor, that person has violated the defendant's due process rights. And this court has held it very clearly, and this is a prototypical application of that Newsom right. Now, I'm going to start with what they call a recent development, this idea that, well, wait a minute, these guys testified at the trial too. As an aside, that's not a development. The defendant knew it, the plaintiff knew it, and the district court knew it. But that's neither here nor there. Your Honor hit it on the head. You can't immunize a due process violation after the fact just because you happen to talk about it on the stand. They're being sued for what they did to Tommy Dye's testimony. In the words of Judge Easterbrook and Newsom, they improperly induced him to falsely finger somebody. And they can't, by then describing that on the stand, ex post facto give themselves immunity. And that's the Bowers case that we cited. It puts it in terms of the immunity for testifying on the stand doesn't relate back to the pre-existing constitutional violation, which is what we have here. And the Spurlock case from the Sixth Circuit tackles that issue head on. You can't, if, for example, if I commit a fraud and then later in another proceeding I talk about that fraud, that doesn't provide immunity for the underlying fraud. They're not being sued for their testimony. They're not being sued for anything surrounding their own testimony. As the district court put it, the fact that they testified, in the district court's word, is a mere fortuity. They are being sued for what they did to Tommy Dye. Now, appellee wins this case for any of three reasons. First of all, as in Newsom, this court doesn't even have to reach the argument that they spend all their time on. You don't have to decide whether a conspiracy to commit perjury is warranting of immunity, because as in Newsom, the way Newsom put it was, McCabe and McNally are not being sued for conspiracy to commit perjury. They're being sued for inducing a witness to falsely finger somebody and then withholding that exculpatory information, the circumstances of that, from the prosecution. That's virtually a quote from the language, and this court can do the same thing without even reaching the question of whether a conspiracy to commit perjury warrants immunity. But if the court does reach the immunity question, this court should decide that the allegation that a conspiracy to commit perjury protects the testifier but does not protect the people who improperly manipulate the testimony. And in our brief, we, with due respect, we incorrectly referred to that as an issue of first impression before this court. It's not. This court has already decided that question. In Newsom, Judge Easterbrook recognized that the Ianco case specifically rejected the very extension that they want to get here. This court said that, yes, a witness's immunity is very important, and it's so important that we're not going to let you circumvent a witness's immunity by calling it a conspiracy to testify falsely. But this court said we're not going to extend that to the people who improperly act upon the person's testimony, who induced the perjury, who suborned the perjury. So this court has rejected the extension that they've proposed, and as we pointed out, other courts have rejected it as well, and it makes sense. A fact that a witness on the stand should feel free to testify without fear of liability, without fear of intimidation or harassment, that's an important principle. And it's important enough that you can't recharacterize it as a conspiracy to commit perjury. But the jump that they seek to make here is to say that, well, anybody who improperly induces that witness to testify falsely, they're entitled to absolute immunity, too. That's
as long as they testify.
As long as, well, what they're trying to do is leverage Tommy Dye's immunity. They want to say because Dye testified, we, the people who conspired, or as Judge Easterbrook put it, we induced him to testify falsely, they want to capture Tommy Dye's immunity. At least that's the way they briefed it. It sounds like they've made a shift now and they're putting all their eggs in their basket of, well, we testified too. But leaving aside the argument that we testified too, the argument in their brief is the absolute immunity of Tommy Dye is so broad that a conspiracy to commit perjury by Tommy Dye would enable those who conspired with Dye to avail themselves of the witness immunity too. And that, of course, turns the policy reasons on their head.
Well, how often will we have this kind of fact situation where the people who allegedly conspire to do that also end up testifying? If it's rare, that's, I guess, Mr. Cordray's position, that evil though it may be, if that occurred, there's this overriding need to protect the correctness of testimonial immunity.
It's not uncommon that a police officer who has an interest in the case would testify. This would be a free pass. This would be because you have the fortuity of happening to talk about the same thing, you could therefore ex post facto immunize your underlying constitutional violation that in this case happened 3 years sooner. That wouldn't make any sense.
What was the setting? I haven't reviewed what this new submission. What is the setting in which these agents were called to testify at the criminal trial?
Well, they were part of the prosecution's team, and they testified to the circumstances of Dye being put in the cell. And you know, in their reply brief, they created a straw man. They suggested that we argued that they were only marginally related to what Dye was talking about. We don't take that position at all. These police officers could have testified straight up to the same thing that Dye testified to. That wouldn't save them. It, as Judge Cannelli put it, it's a mere fortuity that they happened to talk about the same thing. They're not being sued for their testimony, and they couldn't be sued for their testimony. And they couldn't be sued for conspiring to create their own testimony. But what they can be sued for, and Judge Easterbrook held this directly in Newsom, is they can be sued for improperly inducing a witness to lie. They armed him with facts he otherwise wouldn't have known, and they didn't tell anybody that they were arming him with those facts. They promised him rewards, etc. And in Newsom, it's worth noting, Your Honors, that Chicago made the same argument Mr. Cordray just made. They, on the petition for rehearing, they said, hold on a second, you're just repackaging a conspiracy to commit perjury. And Judge Easterbrook rejected it. Judge Easterbrook said,
if Judge Easterbrook were here, he would interrupt you way before I have and tell you that the court held, not Judge Easterbrook.
Fair enough. Per curiam opinion. Thank you, Your Honor. And there's no reason for this court to differ from that conclusion. And then, of course, even if for some reason you did grant their premise that you should have testimonial immunity for conspiring to create perjury, they would still lose, as Your Honor pointed out, because we allege here far more than what they're calling just the conspiracy to commit perjury. There's the creation of the false police report. There's who knows what with the physical evidence. Discovery on that point hasn't proceeded. You know, it remains to be seen what's the story of with those tapes. And they lied to the prosecutors. And this court has recognized in Jones versus Chicago that that's an independently actionable violation of due process. So what they're really trying to do is they're trying to create this giant umbrella. They're saying because we testified and because Dye testified, this absolute immunity shields everything. And by the time of their reply brief, it becomes absurd. They're now saying, well, the creation of the false police report, that's part of our conspiracy, and that relates back to Tommy Dye's testimony. Therefore, testimonial absolute immunity at common law, that shields everything. And this court has never made such a jump. No court has made such a jump, and this court shouldn't make such a jump. I'd like to address briefly his point about the footnote from Imbler. That case is about prosecutors, and it's clearly premised on the notion that prosecutors making prosecutorial decisions when prosecuting cases sit in a unique position in our judicial system. And they have their own check because they're part of a self-disciplining body, and the court said in the text that police officers are not, they don't sit where in the same standing as prosecutors. And in fact, there's a specific danger that police officers don't have a self-correcting check. And so under our system of law, things like absolute immunity are very narrow. And the presumption is that qualified immunity provides specific protection. Because absolute immunity says you don't even have to show up. Case over. Here they're alleged of inducing a witness to finger somebody, putting them on death row for a long time. And their argument is, well, we have absolute immunity. We don't even have to defend. No. Under our system of justice, absolute immunity is a very narrow doctrine. The Supreme Court has said it is exceedingly rare, and the Supreme Court has said that the proponent justifying an extension has to prove that by overriding public policy considerations, and they haven't met that burden here. As a secondary note on the Imbler footnote, interestingly, you know, the case law is very clear that when a prosecutor stops doing things that prosecutors usually do, the immunity disappears. And the best example is the Partee case, which they don't touch in their reply. In other words, in that case, the prosecutors weren't really prosecuting anymore because the case went up on appeal and other lawyers were handling it. And this court specifically held, under those circumstances, since the prosecutor is not technically acting in his quintessential prosecutorial function, now the prosecutor stands in exactly the same shoes as police officers, and they are entitled to nothing but qualified immunity. So even if you grant them that Imbler says you can't let Brady undo absolute immunity, that would only apply to someone who's doing what absolute immunity covers, testifying. But in this case, what they're alleged is three steps removed from Tommy Dye's testimony. He testified, and they're saying, well, his absolute immunity should somehow rest on them because they influenced his testimony, and that's not what Imbler stands for. It's an undue expansion of footnote 34 in Imbler. So the third reason we win, as I mentioned, is that even if you don't agree with anything I've said, the fact is we allege far more than a mere conspiracy to commit perjury. So to summarize, this is a straightforward Newsom claim. You don't even have to reach whether or not the conspiracy to commit perjury is in fact something that entitles someone to immunity because, as Judge Easterbrook said in his first Newsom opinion, where you induce a witness...
Who said?
Judge Easterbrook in the first Newsom opinion.
You weren't listening to him.
No, but the first Newsom opinion wasn't for curiam.
Well, we don't personalize. Once an opinion is issued, it may be altered by somebody, but it's the court that's wrong.
Thank you for that clarification. Yeah. Okay. As this court said in Newsom, if you improperly induce a witness to falsely finger someone for murder they didn't commit and they end up on death row, that is a violation of that person's constitutional rights. And to argue that the Due Process Clause didn't provide recourse for that injury would make a mockery of the Due Process Clause. This case alleges very serious things. Mr. Manning believes he can prove them. But at this point, clearly we can't just knock out the case because they say that somebody took a stand and talked about it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bobby. Mr. Cordray.
Thank you, Your Honor. Several points that came up there. First of all, The testimony was a development since the district court rendered its ruling. If you look in the ruling, it's very clear the district court was not aware that these officers had actually testified. There was then a motions battle. They resisted having this put into the record. After the fact, when the district court was ruling on whether to stay discovery, the district court issued a further opinion in which they attempted to address these issues.
Well, just on that point, so that I'm clear, you got leave of the district court to file
this. Ultimately, we did, yes. Okay. And it's now in the record.
So he was aware
later, but not when it ruled in this case.
Well, was there an attempt to ask him to revisit that in light of this?
The appeal was already here. We were on a briefing schedule. So, no, Your Honor, there was not.
Well, are you suggesting a remand should be in order here?
There could be a remand, although I think that the Supreme Court has specified that immunity should be settled as expeditiously as possible in the case because there are no.
Well, it just seems that expedition could have been aided if this is a significant development and there could have been a motion for it to.
That is a possibility, Your Honor. I do think that with testimony in the record here, this is Briscoe and it is House. And the key part of the argument made here is an attempt to read out of the law this court's opinion in House, which says there is conspiracy immunity. When you testify at trial, you also have immunity against an allegation that you conspired to either give or create perjured testimony, and that is also an immunity that is extensively recognized at the common law.
Let me just try to walk this through so I can understand.
Sure.
Let's take a hypothetical where we could agree a Brady violation occurs.
Newsom is a good example of that.
Yeah. Let's just take a freestanding Brady violation that we would agree with.
Yeah.
Separate and apart from that Brady violation, well, I shouldn't say separate, but in aid of that Brady violation, then we have a situation arguably created here in with these kinds of facts.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the testimony on the subject at trial.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that Brady violation that predates in time the kind of violation that you would say we have here would preclude ever reaching that Brady violation if there was testimony?
I would not, Your Honor. Where there's an actual Brady violation that occurs, if there's evidence in the file that is not turned over to the defense that would be exculpatory, you don't somehow read that out of the world by later testifying at trial. But here, the whole allegation of this conspiracy goes to creating, shaping, and then giving perjured testimony by Dye and by these two agents, all covering the same subjects. And they say that it's a fortuity that they testified at trial. If you look at the transcript, page 13 and page 54, they were both called as witnesses for the defense. There's no fortuity there. They called these witnesses to put their testimony on. So these people testified. It wouldn't immunize some freestanding constitutional violation or some withholding of exculpatory evidence that's separate from the actual creation, shaping, and coaching, whatever is alleged here, of perjured testimony. And no matter how serious the case is, in Imbler itself, it was a murder conviction, and the allegation was the prosecutors used perjured testimony, but the court said where the immunity applies, and here it's both witness and conspiracy immunity, it has to preclude
what
the
what do you
privacy.
Make of Mr. Lowy's distinction about the prosecutorial distinction as opposed to the police function?
It is, as this court said in House, a distinction without a difference, because the question is, do you have an absolute immunity? You do if you're a judge. You do if you're a prosecutor engaged in the prosecutorial function. You do if you're a witness testifying at trial, and you do, and the common law is extensive and uniform, and this court's decision in House recognizes it, if you are alleged to be part of a conspiracy to produce perjured testimony. Those are longstanding immunities. Again, they were recognized for hundreds of years at the common law. They are incorporated into both 1983 and Bivens by the Supreme Court's methodology, and they have to be respected. Even though there are times where there will be some officers who will be allowed to commit wrongs and have to be punished by the government or in a criminal process, for the hundreds and thousands of officers who have not committed wrongs, prosecutors and the like, who have to be able to do their duty. That's the Supreme Court's balance. That's the way they've drawn it. We may or may not agree with it in detail, but that's the law.
Well, if the Supreme Court says anything, we have no...
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, and thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.